The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Yitzchak Shachet now presents his lecture, Gratitude is an Attitude.
What do you want to be when you grow up? It's a question that every kid has been asked at some point in their childhood lifetime. Usually, the responses are linked with heroic fantasies. I want to be a policeman. I want to be a football player, a baseball player. Sometimes the responses are built around or based on and fashioned by social conditions. So a child, for example, from a struggling home might dream of becoming a millionaire so that they will no longer have to struggle. Whilst perhaps somebody who grew up in the hustle and bustle of city life might yearn for life in the country or along those lines. But let's face it, these dreams, these fantasies, they don't really end with childhood, do they? Many an adult might ask themselves, if I could change something about my life, if I could be something else, what would it be? Now, you might not like what I'm about to say, but if, of course, the answer is anything other than what you already are, then you're not entirely happy or at peace with where you are at or what you are presently doing. Let me qualify the statement. To be sure, aspiration is absolutely essential and vital for success. But wanting to escape the reality of your current situation certainly suggests that you're not relaxed, that you're not content. And the question then is that lack of contentedness because your present predicament is simply not suited to you, which is then fair enough, or is it more symptomatic of an otherwise restless heart, such that, frankly, wherever your next stop is going to be, for however long a period of time, you're going to want to, after a while, get right back on the gravy train again. You know, one of the earliest sins in Jewish history, as we well know, is that of the golden calf. It's certainly one of the most enigmatic stories in all of Jewish history. Think about this for a second. The Jewish people just experienced the great manifestations of divine benevolence. They escaped their Egyptian taskmasters. They crossed an impregnable sea. They had all the food and all the sustenance and all the water required. Everything was there in surplus in their otherwise desert world. In short, miracles abounded. They had everything. God was everywhere. But they were not happy. There was no appreciation. There was no real sense of gratitude. I have God. I'm experiencing God on so many levels, but it's not enough. Now I want to see God on my terms, by my own definition. And so they make a golden calf. You know how they say, you can never have too much of a good thing? Well, it seems that the Jews in the desert certainly did. They had an abundance of good things. But the biggest problem and the biggest nemesis in life, in society, in relationships, at work, in fact, in virtually every dimension of our existence, is that familiarity breeds contempt. And the truth of the matter is, there's no such thing as having too much. And there's no such a thing as having too much of a good thing other than the insatiable character it carves out in the unappreciative. And I believe, and again, this is going to be a very controversial statement, that we all have golden calves. Not objects, but images. The image of being something that we are not. The image of being more successful. The image of needing to appear more beautiful. the image of being happier than what we might already be. And thus, even as you are here, you're already looking to see what's out there, such that you never really get to thoroughly enjoy the here. You never really learn to live in the moment and to appreciate what you have now. The reality is that our desires always disappoint us, because even when we meet with something that gives us satisfaction, it never thoroughly answers our expectations. And our rabbis famously have this succinct expression for this. When they ask the question, who is wealthy? This is an ethics of the fathers. And they answer, one who is satisfied with their lot. One of the great undiscovered joys of life comes from recognizing that your given set of circumstances is where you are meant to be. There's a treasure to be unearthed in doing everything you can and to the best of your ability where you find yourself now. And when you're honest enough with yourself and you pause long enough to simply look around you and take in the scene of the people who cherish your love, of a workplace that values your input, of an endeavor that necessitates your expertise, of a project that requires your enthusiasm, then you'll appreciate, hey, this is where I am. This is where I can make my difference. This is where I am meant to be able to discover meaning and lasting satisfaction. And so sometimes the problem with having too much of a good thing is what you might call system overload. You know how you lose something, and then you go searching for it. What does the people say? It's always in the last place you look. I never understood why they say that. Of course it's in the last place you look. It's not as if you're going to find it and then continue looking beyond that point. But the reason it takes longer than expected, as we can all probably relate to, the reason why it takes longer than expected to find where you put those car keys or where you left your wallet is because of what we call system overload. In other words, in that initial state of panic, when you realize that something of importance is missing, all the many places that you think you might have left it comes rushing to the fore of your brain. And then it's all one big mumble jumble of all sorts of ideas. And so in the process, you become confused and you can't think and you can't recall, where is it? It's only when you take time out, it's only when you suddenly choose to step back, it's when you pause and you relax your mind that everything then falls into sequence, and your brain will then systematically process and focus on each place you visited before you realized it was missing. And then you find it in the last place you look. Authors, scriptwriters, lecturers, yes, even rabbis, when having to deliver talks, will tell you that sometimes so many ideas come crashing on the shores of one's creativity that the brain just literally jams to a halt. And the answer in that moment is that you need to literally distract yourself with something altogether disconnected with whatever else you're working on, so that the structure of ideas can then be better filtered through, and you'll have that aha moment. Why am I telling you this? Because the Jews in the desert were being plied with miracle upon miracle upon miracle. It was system overload, such that they couldn't pause long enough to focus on the immediate and individual blessings in their lives. And so they make a golden calf. And God's response is that he's withdrawing himself from them. As he said to Moses, I'll let an angel lead you instead. Maybe it wasn't so much a punishment as a means for time out. In the vacuum, they can pause, reflect, and better appreciate what once filled the void. And the message to you and me is that often, precisely when so many things are going well at once, we lose perspective. And as soon as one or more of those things don't go entirely to plan, we panic, we throw in the towel, we get ready to move on to something else. That, as the Jews in the desert came to discover, is a recipe for disaster. Imagine you're in a museum and you're looking up at a beautiful, tiled, magnificent ceiling with a mosaic made up of thousands of tiles. And as you glance around, you notice that one of the tiles is missing. Although, in actual fact, the rest of the ceiling is beautiful and magnificent and perfect, where do you think your eyes are going to likely focus on most? Upon that one missing tile. And that's what we human beings do. We have a tendency to focus on the missing tile instead of what is present, on what is wrong instead of what is right in our lives. And that's what's been called the missing tile syndrome. Even if we have a life that is filled with blessings, we often obsess on that which is missing to such an extent that it literally distracts our day-to-day happiness. In fact, seldom do we recognize and appreciate that we possess incredible riches. In fact, every single one of us possesses incredible riches far beyond all of the combined treasures and wealth of the Forbes 500. It's simple math. Would you sell your health for 5 billion pounds? Add up your assets and you'll find that you won't sell what you possess for all the wealth in the world. Or as somebody once said, if you ever want to know how wealthy you really are, then count all those things you possess that money can't buy. Or to put it differently, a wise mathematician said, the hardest arithmetic is to master, or the hardest arithmetic to master, is that which enables us to count our blessings. We have to learn to focus less on the missing tile and focus so much more on the beautiful ceiling that makes up the beautiful mosaic of our lives. Back then, almost at every single juncture, they complained, they kvetched. They kvetched about the water, even though they had it. They kvetched about the food, even though they had it. They kvetched about the difficulties of the journey, even though everything was being provided for them, and so on and so forth. They focused continuously on the missing tile, not the blessings that they had received. In fact, one outstanding example is when they came even before Sinai to a place called Marah. Marah is a word we know similar to marar, bitter. That was the name of the place. Why? Because the waters there tasted bitter. And the commentaries ask the question, did the waters really taste bitter? Or was it the disposition of the people? That they were in a kind of bitter state, disgruntled state, dissatisfied state, such that the waters tasted bitter. It can happen. That sometimes you are so restless and so disgruntled that regardless, it can impact on your psyche to an extent where it even affects your senses. So the waters weren't bitter, it was the disposition of the people that was bitter. They were unhappy. And the Torah tells us that then and there, God gave them already certain mitzvot. Even prior to Sinai, they were given, for example, already the mitzvah of Shabbos, amongst other mitzvot. Why Shabbos? Because Shabbos is that one day in the week when we have opportunity to pause and to reflect on the blessings around us. From Sunday to Friday, we're running around in the hustle and bustle of everything going on around us. And we get so consumed with life, and we are leading such a restless heart, looking to make yet another acquisition, to achieve more, etc. We never pause to smell the roses, to appreciate the inherent blessings all around us. Shabbos is that magic moment. Friday night, a wise man once told me, when we sing Shalom Aleichem on Friday night, welcoming the angels, we're not just welcoming the angels that the rabbis tell us that accompany each of us on a Friday night, home from shul to the house or wherever. We're also singing Shalom Aleichem, welcoming the angels that are always there in our lives, our husbands, our wives, our children. Only again, we're too busy throughout the course of the week to necessarily pause, recognize, appreciate, and express gratitude for that. Friday night, we pause and we sing Shalom Aleichem. This is the moment that we have in the week that we can appreciate the blessings. And yes, it's also additionally incumbent upon every man thereafter to sing the song Eshet Chayil, a woman of valor, a woman of worth, an opportunity to reflect the special gift and the good fortune that he has of a spouse who makes sure of the constant running of the household, the children, and so on and so forth as well. So yes, God gave them that mitzvah even before Sinai, when they stood there in that moment, feeling so bitter to the point and to the extent that the water started to taste bitter as well. And that's the reality with us people, unfortunately. When things go wrong, you'll always hear about it. When things go right, not so much. You know, there's that story they always tell about this boy. He never talked. His parents were really concerned. They took him to doctors. They took him to specialists. And they tried everything, and they could find nothing wrong with the boy. But he never, ever spoke a word. 6 years. And then one morning at breakfast, he looked up and he said, "Mom, my oatmeal's cold." Imagine the elation. He could talk. He was healthy. They danced around the room. They're jumping up and down. They call everybody. And finally, the mother stops and she asks him, she goes, "Why did you never speak until now?" He says, "Until now, everything was good." People are not too quick to speak up and express gratitude, but they certainly always find their voices when they need to complain. Not only does expressing our gratitude obviously make other people feel good, it's also very good for us as well, and I'll tell you why. One of the most fundamental laws in psychology is that it's impossible for a human mind to think about two things or more than one thing simultaneously at any given time. If you don't believe it, try it. Try in the same instant to think about what you had for supper last night and what lecture you plan to go on after this. You can't do it. You can only focus on either thought in turn, but never both simultaneously. And the same is true in the field of emotions. Gratitude is a positive feeling. Sadness is a negative feeling. The two obviously cannot coexist. You cannot be happy and grateful for something and feel sad and down at the very same time. Simply put, one emotion drives out the other. When we feel grateful, then in that moment, happiness follows. Gratitude is not just good for the other, it's good for you too. In that moment, you're happy. There's no space for the sadness. What's the single greatest obstacle to happiness and gratitude? Human nature. Human nature is insatiable. We're never completely satisfied with ourselves. We're never completely satisfied with our partners. We're never completely satisfied with our incomes or with our homes or with our children or with our jobs, our pleasures, etc. Something in us is always longing for more, for greater perfection. Consider, in fact, the order of every single child's words. What's the first word that a child speaks? Often it's mama. The second is dada, or in the reverse. But the third word usually is more. These words perfectly express our deepest urges, first for love and security, and then for more of everything. Now, this doesn't mean that we can't be happy. However, it does not serve us well to think that the outside world is always to blame for our dissatisfaction, when truly, even if we had everything imaginable, the world could never really properly satisfy us if we tried. So working on our inner thoughts is part of that fundamental journey to becoming happier, to be able, in effect, to convey to our own innate nature that although we hear that it wants more, it's our minds, not our nature, that will determine whether we are satisfied. It's about pausing, thinking, reflecting, appreciating, being grateful for all that we do have. There was a customer who called over a waiter in a restaurant. He says, "Oh, it's too hot in here. Please turn up the air conditioning." The waiter goes out. 5 minutes later, he summons the waiter again. "Oh, it's now gotten too cold in here. Please turn down the air conditioning." The waiter goes out again. 5 minutes later, "It's gotten really hot in here. I need you to turn up the air conditioning again." For the third time, the waiter starts to leave, and as he's heading out, another diner sitting there, taking in the scene, stops the waiter and says, "You know, I feel so sorry for you. That man is driving you mad." And the waiter replies, "Actually, it's me who's driving him mad. You see, we don't have any air conditioning." From which I conclude that what we think in here affects what we feel out there. And therefore, rather than allowing your innate nature that remains eminently insatiable to always take control and make you feel ungrateful for what you already have, use your minds to focus on your blessings. Express your gratitude, be grateful, and the rest of life will take care of itself. Martin Seligman, the godfather of positive psychology, expressed this best through an exercise he called the gratitude visit. His instructions were simple. He told his group of subjects, close your eyes, call up the face of someone still alive who did something or said something that changed your life for the better. Someone whom you may not have properly thanked, but that you could still manage to meet face to face next week. And he instructed, after you identify this person, he suggested you write a letter that expresses your gratitude to that person, and then deliver that in person. Your letter should be concrete, and your letter should include specific actions or statements about how that person made a very real difference in your life. And as he later recorded, as an example, he said, consider the letter that University of Montana student Paul Glassman wrote to his mother and consequently went to her to read about to her. He said, Mom, from when I was born until now, you have been impacting my life every single day. When I was in high school, you were always there for me, looking after me. You came to every single sporting event that you possibly could, even if that meant that you had to leave work early to catch the bus to get there. You were there even if it was pouring rain. You pushed me continuously to do well in school because you wanted me to go to college. I know that if it wasn't for you, I would never have properly continued my education. Through the toughest of times and through the best of times, you've been there to support me. You are such an amazing human being and an even better mother. Thank you for all the time and effort and hard work that you have taken into making me the man that I am today. I love you with all my heart. And it's clear when Glassman visited his mother and read out the letter, it was a peak experience for her. If you take that moment, and it's worthwhile experimenting in doing the same sort of thing, you have no idea what kind of impact it can make on the other person. It let her know that her son sees her and provided a deep emotional message that moved her. But the visit was also, as Seligman records, a defining moment for Glassman himself. In fact, he cited it as the single most memorable experience of his college days. And Seligman and his team of scientists found that if you conduct a gratitude visit, you feel a rush of happiness afterwards. In fact, it's one of the most pronounced spikes that have ever been found in any positive psychology intervention. That's what Glassman experienced. Better yet, researchers say that that feeling of happiness, it lasts. Even a month later, people who conducted a gratitude visit, part of his experiment, were still happier than their peers in the same control group. It's a stunning finding. There are many pleasures in the world that we can all experience that will invariably spike your happiness levels for a couple of hours, maybe even a day, like a good matzo ball or a fine single malt. But not many can actually spike you suddenly to actually last a whole month or longer. That's the power of gratitude. That's what Seligman demonstrated purely by encouraging his subjects in the control group to go out there and write that gratitude letter to somebody who made that difference. Now I want to take this one critical spiritual step further. You know, there's an expression in the Talmud. We have a similar expression in English, probably borrowed from the Talmud. Don't throw stones into the well from which you drink. On the one hand, it's obviously a metaphor for the need to be nice to those who are nice to you. It's another way of saying, don't bite the hand that feeds you. But if that's all it's saying, then why use that strange analogy altogether? Tell me straight up, be nice to those who are nice to you. What's a well and what's stones got to do with anything? Obviously, it's saying something so much more with a powerful lesson for each of us in life. But let me preface with another statement from our rabbis, where it says, whoever denies the good shown to them by another is tantamount to denying the very existence of God. And you've got to wonder, what on earth has one thing got to do with the other? They cite the example of Pharaoh. Pharaoh, we're told in the first instance, didn't remember Joseph, in the words of the Torah, and then later he finds himself asking, who is God that I should listen to him? In other words, to recap, Joseph was the one who stepped up as viceroy in Egypt. He prevented market meltdown. He literally saved the entire economy and countless lives in the process. How could Pharaoh forget Joseph? Even if, as some suggest, it wasn't the same Pharaoh, is it feasible to imagine that, even if he never met him, that he didn't know who he was or what he did to spare so many from the famine that ravaged that part of the world? Have you ever heard here about World War I or World War II? Have you ever heard about Albert Einstein or Winston Churchill? You never met them. You never experienced these events or these people, but you certainly know about them. You know their achievements. You know their accomplishments. And when it came to Egypt, hunger was rampant, something that everybody would have talked about for generations after. And Joseph was the Hebrew who saved them, whom they would have also talked about for generations after. So who are we kidding when we say Pharaoh didn't know about Joseph? Obviously, he made himself as though he didn't know Joseph. He chose to ignore the incredible good that Joseph did. He was ungrateful, no gratitude. You know, life is actually a lot more convenient that way. Psychologically, when somebody does you a favor, you can either feel gratitude, you can either feel appreciation, or you might have enough of an ego that you don't want to feel indebted. And therefore, it's so much easier to negate that person and what they did for you if opportunity lends itself. What is it Mark Twain famously said? If you pick up a starving dog and make him prosperous, he will not bite you. This is the principal difference between a dog and a man. Or as this famous story told about the Chassam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Schreiber of the 18th century, a member of the community needed to borrow a very large sum of money and approached him for a loan. And the next day when he met with him, he handed him two bags. One was filled with all the ruble he required. The other was filled with small pebbles. And the man asked the esteemed rabbi, "What's with the pebbles?" And the Chassam Sofer replied, "In years to come, when you should be inclined to want to throw stones at me, I don't want that it should hurt." Or as many of our grandparents used to say, "Why does he hate me so much? I never did him any favors." So Pharaoh chose not to remember Joseph. He didn't want to have to feel that sense of indebtedness or, frankly, any kind of responsibility or gratitude towards the Jewish people. But why does that behavior necessarily lead to denying the existence of God? How might the idea of being an ingrate lead to being an apostate? So let me digress here for a moment. A little while back, a number of years ago, I was traveling abroad, and I had to travel via New York. I stopped in New York to go to the oil hall, whatever, and I had this ostentatious sling on my hand because I've had shoulder surgery. Interestingly enough, when I was checking in at Heathrow Airport, going through security, all of a sudden this guy behind me turns around and he says to me, "Oh, I recognize you from the BBC, The Big Questions. What happened to your hand?" I was like, "Really? We just met." So I just looked at him, I said, "Well, I had shoulder surgery." And he says, "Oh, wow, okay, fine." And I said, "Let me help you with your bags." And he suddenly helps me put my bags onto the security conveyor belt, et cetera, because security guys are never going to help you with that. And afterwards, he followed me through, and I see he's on the same escalator. He keeps wanting and insisting to carry my bag, and pretty soon I determine he's actually on my flight, at which point I kind of looked up to the heavens and said, "Please make sure he's not sitting next to me." But that didn't happen. That was okay. But nevertheless, he was literally there all the way through, suddenly appearing out of nowhere, helping me through the process. And as I'm there on the other side, and I'm in New York, and I'm getting ready to leave, I go into a coffee shop to get a coffee. And the sling is on this hand, and my wallet is in this pocket, so I'm kind of like this. And all of a sudden, a voice behind me suddenly says, "Rabbi Shochet, let me get the coffee for you." And I looked up, and there was this guy who was about 6'2", pretty much both ways. And I looked at him, and I said, "Do I know you?" And he says, "Yeah, my last name is Brooke. You taught me in eighth grade when you were still living in New York." Yeah, I remembered him. I mean, he was a really obnoxious kid at the time. One of his friends might be here and might repeat that, but don't. Anyway, and after we stood there enjoying our soya lattes, I said to him, "So was I that good of a teacher that you buy me my coffee 3 decades later?" And he says, "I have absolutely no idea. I don't remember. One thing is for sure. If you were a bad teacher, I would have remembered and not be buying you one. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, well, how do you think I immediately remembered your first name? You were the most difficult kid in the class. But the latte was too good, and I kept my mouth shut. And I mention all this because on later reflection, I'm considering how there I was, on the one hand, alone, struggling, just a little bit, and of all the random people to suddenly be there in the airport, this one guy emerges out of nowhere to offer help and guide me along. And then I'm in the airport trying to get my wallet out to pay for a coffee, and there is this random person, although from my past, who's there to suddenly help me along. And I think it's fair to say that there are such people that we encounter in one form or another in all of our lives in different scenarios. There are those closest to us whom we might typically take for granted. After all, it's part of the deal, right? There are people in our lives, parents and spouses and siblings and strangers, and we can find 101 reasons why we shouldn't have to acknowledge what they do for us. He's my dad, of course he ensured a good education. She's my wife, of course she cooked me dinner. Regardless of what you think is the other person's motive, because that's their presumed responsibility, nothing is of course. Nothing should be ever taken for granted. By the way, of course is two words made up of 8 letters. So is thank you. Here's a startling thought. Again, in the Torah, we read about the servitude in Egypt. The Torah doesn't mince its words. It's pretty nasty stuff. They subjected us to all kinds of pain and suffering. And that's why we eat the maror on Seder night, to recollect all the pain endured. And yet we find a curious commandment in the Torah. The Torah categorically instructs, do not reject the Egyptian because you were a guest in its land. In that law, the Torah enumerates certain nations who could never convert and become part of the Jewish nation, and that on account of the particular atrocities perpetuated at different intervals against the Israelites and during their varied journeys. Now, you'd immediately assume that the Egyptians should be top of that banned list. And yet, nonetheless, insists God in the Torah, don't reject them. After all, they were there for you in your time of need. To be clear, they enslaved the Jews. They tortured them. They killed them. They nearly wiped them off the map of world civilization. But, says the Torah, at some earlier point in time, they also gave you refuge. Still before the servitude, during that time of famine in the story of Joseph, they enabled the whole household of Jacob to settle in their land. To be sure, this is not about saying thank you to the evildoers themselves. They were every bit cruel and needed to be called to account for their actions and endured the penalty accordingly. But the country per se, there was once something nice that they did for the sake of the Jewish nation, and the Torah mandates that we never, ever lose sight of whatever goodness and graciousness shown to us. That's how much emphasis the Torah puts on the essential need for gratitude. And consider further, who was the bona fide leader of the Jewish nation? None other than Moses himself. Why was Moses, Moshe so-called? How did he get that name? The Torah tells us right at the outset, because Pharaoh's daughter called him so when she rescued him in his basket from the river. Ki min hamayim mishi sihu, because I drew him out from the water. Now think about this for a second. A little while before he found himself in that basket, he will have already had a bris, he would have been circumcised, he would have been given a name by his parents. That name, amongst others that the sages suggest to us, was Tuvia, which means the good of God. And yet God, and by extension you and me, know him as Moshe. Why? Because that name reflects something special that somebody else did for him. Someone reached out to him. Someone helped him. Someone saved him from the river when he was in that basket. Someone gave him reason to be grateful. And to be frank, in God's eyes, that principle is so incredibly paramount. God expresses his gratitude by giving Moshe and calling Moshe by the very name of Pharaoh's daughter, reflecting how she saved him in that basket. And consider further, the first 3 of the 10 plagues, blood, frogs, and water, and lice. How did the blood and the frogs come about? It involved having to take a stick and hitting the water. How did the lights come about? It involved having to take a stick and hitting the sand. It wasn't Moshe, but Aaron who had to carry out those first three plagues. Why? Because the water saved Moshe when he was in the basket, and it would be inappropriate for him to go hitting those waters. Why? Because the sand saved Moshe when he smote the Egyptian and buried him in that actual sand, and it would be inappropriate for him to be hitting the sand that helped him in that moment of need. You have to wonder, these are inanimate objects, water, sand, and yet still Moshe had to show gratitude. He couldn't hit them. Why? The water doesn't know. The water doesn't feel. The water doesn't care whether you appreciate it or not. So why the need to be so sensitive to these inanimate things? And at a basic level, it's because it's about conditioning yourself. The water or the sand may not feel anything or couldn't care less, but it's about conditioning yourself to just learn to be more appreciative in life. And if you can do that with the inanimate, then you'll learn all the more so to do that with people as well. I was sitting with somebody recently. I've been studying with him from when he was 8 years old. Today he's 35, 36 years old. We've been learning once a week for all those many years. And recently we were sitting there and, you know, we're going on ChatGPT to look up something. And he starts typing in, can you please tell me, blah, blah, blah. I said, why are you being polite to ChatGPT? Just ask the question. And light in a flash, he said to me, you once taught me this importance about showing gratitude even to inanimate object so that you condition yourself to be that way. But there's a deeper dimension to this. You see, when that water is there to save you whilst you're floating in a basket, that's because God intended for it to serve that purpose in that moment in time. When the sand is there to hide the Egyptian, it doesn't matter how many people were walking on that sand and benefiting from it. Right here, right now, God intended that these tiny grains of sand should be there to serve your purpose for hiding the evidence when you smote the Egyptian. And if you aren't grateful, then that is tantamount to denying the existence of God and his specific intent of orchestrating all the moving parts as he does everything else in your life to make it available to you in that moment. And so coming back to the earlier point, you're walking in the desert and you come across a well of water to drink from. It doesn't matter how long that well of water might have been there. It doesn't matter how many other people might have drank from that water. Right here, right now, God intended for that well of water to be there for you, to quench your thirst. And that's part of the divine plan. So if you throw stones into that well, then you are, to all intent and purposes, like throwing stones at God's plan, and that's why it's like denying the existence of God. Rabbi Yisrael Gustman was a great rabbi of the 20th century. His life story is phenomenal, the way he escaped Nazis, the way he lived in pig pens, the way he survived off random greenery in the fields, and much else besides. It's the stuff of legends. He headed a yeshiva in Israel, and he was regularly seen watering the plants every single morning. And when somebody once commented to him and said to him, Rabbi, it's completely inappropriate and not respectful for a man of your stature to be doing that sort of thing, he explained, the plants saved my life, and this is my payback. It's the same principle. When plants are there to save you from the pursuing Nazis, it's all part of divine providence. Be grateful, show gratitude, be appreciative. If you're not grateful, then you are being an ingrate. You're denying God's presence in your life. And how much more so when another person comes your way and does you that special favor? That guy who recognizes you from television, or that student from three decades ago, there's something about you that they appreciate, however subtle or remote it might be. And they want to show you a kindness. Should that in turn not be appreciated by you? Is that not God's way of sending people your way to help you when you wonder how you're going to cope in a particular situation? There was a patient who turns to his doctor after many months of extensive treatment for a dangerous illness. And at the end of it, he looks and says, Doctor, you know what? We've become close friends. I'm not going to embarrass you by offering you payment for the treatment you gave me. But as a sign of my gratitude, I just want you to know I put you in my will to thank you for all the time over these past many months. The doctor looks at him a little taken aback. He goes, well, okay, that's really kind of you. Just one thing. If you can give me back that prescription I just gave you, I'd like to make a little adjustment to it. You know, it always struck me how at a shiva, no one should ever know, people assemble and they talk about the person. They share really wonderful anecdotes, the personal favors they experienced, the gestures they were shown, the wisdom imparted, the help they were offered at different times. It's beautiful. In fact, it's one of the most beautiful aspects of a Shiva, that you get to hear so many things that you might have otherwise never heard or known about in regard to that particular person, in regard to that particular loved one. My only question is this. Did you ever tell it to that person themselves while they were still alive? All those wonderful things, all that appreciation that you're relaying. Did you ever share it with the individual concerned whilst they were still living? Think of a person who might have been there for you, even if only many, many years ago, maybe as a child, as a teenager, as a young adult. Have you shown them gratitude? Have you said thank you? And if it's not too late, then it's not too late. You know, there was a man who really didn't have a whole lot to do with Judaism. But when a certain rabbi would visit him annually to raise funds for his yeshiva, he would give generously to the particular yeshiva. And the rabbi once plucked up the courage and he asked him straight. He said to him, listen, you don't have any appreciation for Judaism per se. Why is it that you tend to always give me such a large sum of money for my particular yeshiva? To which the older man replied, many years ago, I was a young yeshiva student in Radin by the famed Chofetz Chaim. My parents thought that somehow that yeshiva would be able to straighten me out. But I was a rebel there, and it was decided I'd have to be sent home. The faculty contacted the Chofetz Chaim, and they asked, the hour is late. Can I stay in the yeshiva overnight and just leave on the next train the next morning? And he insisted, no, he should really leave already tonight. But let him stay in my house in the meantime until the next morning. He said, it's better that way. I don't want his influence to spread, etc. And he says, and he continues, I was put to sleep in the saintly rabbi's study. I was still awake, I was restless, when he came in near midnight, though he thought I was asleep. And realizing it was particularly chilly in the house, he took his cloak off himself and covered me with it. And then he added, that happened maybe 50 or so years ago, but I'm still warm from that coat. So let me leave you with this. There was a tremendous battle that we read about in the Tanakh. During the 8th century BCE, the Neo-Assyrian Empire under the rule of King Sennacherib had a series of conflicts with the kingdom of Judah, ruled by King Hizkiyahu. And these conflicts are part of the larger Assyrian campaigns to expand their empire, etc. And a great miracle transpired, as we read about in Tanakh. God essentially fought the battle by way of angels sparing the Jewish people. And the Talmud famously tells us that God wanted to make that battle that was taking place, the famous battle of what we refer to as Gog and Magog, that's to precede the coming of Mashiach, and then God wanted to make King Hizkiyahu himself Mashiach. And then the Talmud relates to us that the angels obstructed the process. They came before the Almighty and they said, Uma David HaMelech, is King David, said before you all kinds of praise of thanksgiving, the famous book of Psalms that he compiled. You didn't make him Mashiach. Chizkiyahu Shaloya Melefanecha, Chizkiyahu, who did not say before you, sings of praise and gratitude, him you do want to make Mashiach. You know, it's a fascinating thing. When you look throughout all of the Tanakh, you will always find, obviously, in the Hebrew alphabet, there are certain letters that are final letters. You only find them at the end of a word. A final mem, a final nun, a final pei. Obviously, they're end letters. You won't find them in the middle of a word, bar one particular word, Lamar Ba'amishra, one particular word in the story about Hizkiyahu, an end letter in the middle of a word, a closed mem. Because the rabbis tell us in that moment, an opportunity was lost. It became closed. It was taken away. Hizkiyahu was going to be made Mashiach. Why was the opportunity lost? Because he didn't sing songs of thanks. He didn't express gratitude in the way that should have been expected. Had he expressed gratitude, had he sang song of thanks, the angels would have had no claim and God would have made him Mashiach, says the Rebbe. From here we see that expressing gratitude is such an important principle, it literally helps to bring Mashiach. You know, we're meant to make 100 blessings a day. Prayer covers some of it. Much of the rest is covered by a variety of food that we eat before and after, which in the retreat is certainly not a problem. And it's based on the verse in Deuteronomy, in Devarim. where it says, Ma Hashem Elokecha, last week's Torah portion. What is it that God asks of you? Nothing other than to fear God. And the word Ma is like the word Mea, which means 100. 100 blessings. That's what God asks of you. Make 100 blessings. Thank Him continuously every single day. Every day we need to be thankful to the tremendous blessings we receive. Make that gratitude list and come to discover how every day is an opportunity to express gratitude to God, to other people, for the blessings that they add to your life. Ignore the missing tile and embrace the beautiful ceiling above you, and you'll discover the inherent and enduring happiness for a long time to come. So take time out. Focus on each dimension of your life. Learn to appreciate each moment in its own right and within its own context. Feel gratitude, be thankful. We navigate the highs and the lows on the graph of life, but our objective is to stay focused throughout. Appreciate the miracles that go on in your life every single day. Learn to enjoy every minute. Live in the present. Launch yourself on every wave. Find your eternity in each moment and experience a continuous abundance of blessing in your lives forevermore. Thank you.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.